December 7th, 1941. As President Franklin D. Roosevelt would later attribute it, a day that would live in infamy. The largest and most powerful carrier force ever assembled, flying under the flag of the Imperial Japanese Navy, struck the American naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. The attack catches the United States of America completely off guard, and the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet is decimated, save for their aircraft carriers, which, by a stroke of luck, were out of the harbor at the time of the attack. Over the coming months, the Japanese Navy appears invincible as it powers through the Pacific Ocean, destroying American, Australian, and British warships, as well as anyone else who stands in their way. But the legendary Japanese Admiral Yamamoto knows that as long as the American carriers remain, they are still at risk of a reversal of their fortunes. Thus, he decides to set a trap for them, using a bait he knows the Americans won't ignore. His target is a small atoll positioned roughly halfway between Japan and North America. This is the story of the Battle of Midway. Prior to the outbreak of the Second World War, naval planners were still debating on just what role the aircraft carrier would play in future wars fought at sea. This resulted in most navies being split into one of two camps, the first being that naval aircraft would remain primarily in an extension of the existing battle fleet, finding enemy fleets and weakening them prior to the battleships going in, which would remain the final word in naval warfare. Aircraft would of course also have to fend off enemy aircraft trying to do the same. However, some argued that naval aircraft were advancing at a rapid rate and their firepower had enormous potential to affect the course of a battle, and thus the days of the battleship being the main instrument of naval warfare were now over. Of all the great navies, Japan probably took the most balanced approach in its shipbuilding program. While the US and Great Britain were content with modernizing many of their dreadnoughts built up to the end of World War I, Japan continued to build more modern battleships, culminating, of course, in the awe-inspiring Yamato class of ships, despite international treaties that tried to limit the construction of such vessels. At the same time, the Imperial Japanese Navy also built up the largest carrier force in the world, with four light and six fleet carriers by 1941, and these were backed up by long-range, land-based twin-engined torpedo bombers. Masterminding this naval aviation construction program was Admiral Yamamoto, himself having a background in naval gunnery before realizing aircraft were the future. Thus, when Yamamoto was tasked with conceiving of a plan to attack the US naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, at the forefront of his mind was destroying the three US fleet carriers stationed there, the Enterprise CV-6, the Lexington CV-2, and the Saratoga CV-3. Yet despite his task force, commanded by Vice Admiral Nagumo, enjoying total surprise on the morning of December 7th, 1941, by an incredible stroke of luck for the Americans, all three carriers were not present, being engaged on other duties. Saratoga was in San Diego, having recently completed an overhaul. Enterprise and its escorts were delivering fighter aircraft to Wake Island, while Lexington was delivering aircraft to the then relatively little-known island of Midway. No one could deny that Japanese aircraft inflicted terrible losses on the US Pacific Fleet's battleships that infamous Sunday morning. However, for Yamamoto, it was a job half done, without the US carriers having also been taken out of the equation. This, he knew, would make the crucial next stage of the resulting war in the Pacific all the more difficult for Japan. Before December 1941, Yamamoto had warned his superiors that in his estimation, Japan would have 6 months after the start of hostilities with which to decisively defeat the US Navy in battle, forcing the US to the negotiating table where Washington would have to accept Japanese supremacy over the Pacific. After those 6 months were up, the mighty US industrial complex, which was immune from interference from Japan or their German and Italian allies, would be able to produce war supplies at a significantly higher rate than the Japanese. In a war of attrition against a fully geared up United States, Japan would be ground down and ultimately defeated. In the immediate months after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese appeared unstoppable, taking the US Philippines, the Dutch East Indies, the British Empire possessions of Hong Kong and Singapore, and were charging into China, Burma, and eventually India. Unfortunately for Yamamoto, though, the US carriers eluded him, and their destruction was made all the more vital when the US Army Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle used the carrier USS Hornet to do the unthinkable and carry out a token bombing of the Japanese home islands on April 18, 1942. Yamamoto finally got his chance on May 4, 1942, when his carriers met the American carriers Yorktown and Lexington in the Battle of the Coral Sea. During the four-day engagement, itself a first for naval warfare in that it was fought exclusively by aircraft, meaning the crews of opposing ships never saw one another, the Japanese succeeded in sinking the fleet carrier Lexington and damaging Yorktown, but suffered the loss of the light carrier Shoho and damage to the Japanese carriers Shokaku and Zuikaku, meaning both were out of the war for several months, a serious blow to Yamamoto's force. As his own six-month timetable began to tick down, Yamamoto realized he needed to lure the American carriers into battle where they could be destroyed, and soon, while his carrier fleet still held a numerical advantage. He therefore decided to commit his fleet to an operation he knew would be of such a threat to the US that it would force the Americans to respond with their carriers, and selected Midway Island as his objective. Capturing Midway Island would seriously damage US naval operations in the Pacific, denying them the use of the island as a refueling stop. It would also afford the Japanese a staging area where they could build up their strength in preparation for a future invasion of Hawaii if the war continued long enough. It was, therefore, the ideal bait. Midway is an atoll located in the North Pacific Ocean and comprises two distinct islands. The main island is known as Sand Island and has an area of just 1,117 acres, while adjacent sits the smaller strip of land known simply as Eastern Island, with just 366 acres. Its name derives from the fact that it is almost completely equidistant between North America and Asia, and approximately one-third of the distance from Hawaii to Japan. The first recorded sighting of the islands was made in 1859 by the American sealing ship Gambier, under the command of Captain Brooks, who combined his name and their location to name the atoll Middlebrook Islands. Over time, however, this fell out of use and was replaced simply with Midway. There were numerous small settlements set up on the islands in the years after its discovery, and its importance only grew after the start of the Trans-Pacific passenger flights by Pan Am's airline fleet of flying boats, which used the islands as a stopover. In order to help maintain US authority over the islands, a small US Marine garrison was stationed on Sand Island beginning in 1904, along with the construction of a radio station for the relaying of messages. As relations between the US and Japan began to sour in 1941, the US Navy decided to construct an air station on Eastern Island to act as a refueling stop for long-range bombers and transports, as well as to help defend it against attack and track Japanese fleet movements. Then, on the morning of December 7, 1941, as Japanese bombs and torpedoes rained down on Pearl Harbor, two Japanese destroyers, the Sazanami and Ushio, broke off from their main fleet and attacked the US garrison stationed on Midway, shelling their positions for almost an hour before breaking off to rejoin their comrades. First Lieutenant George H. Cannon, USMC, was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions during the attack when, despite being wounded from incoming fire, he refused to leave his post until those under his command, who had also been wounded, were evacuated first. This ultimately cost him his life. Midway was again attacked on the evening of February 8, 1942, when the Japanese submarine I-169 surfaced near Sand Island and fired a salvo of three 100mm shells at the US Navy radio station, but alert US Marine gunners spotted the sub and quickly returned fire, forcing it to flee before any real damage could be done. Yet, despite these attacks, as it became clear to US intelligence in spring of 1942 that the Japanese were planning something big, there was still some debate as to whether the next Japanese push would be against Midway or another US target in the Pacific, most likely being a direct invasion of Hawaii. This was the question that dominated one Lieutenant Commander Joseph Rochefort and his team of codebreakers and linguists, who worked in a cramped, windowless room at Pearl Harbor, intercepting Japanese transmissions and decoding them. They became so proficient at breaking the Japanese code, known as JN-25B, that at times they were decoding the encrypted messages faster than the Japanese themselves. However, decoding a message is one thing. Understanding its meaning is quite another. Rochefort and his team began to realize that the Japanese were amassing their forces for an attack against a target they had designated rather cryptically as AF. But just where was AF? The Japanese reports regarding AF could have referred to any number of American or Allied bases in the Pacific, so what was needed was for the Japanese to say something specific that would tip Rochefort off as to where they were referring to. His first break came in March, when a Japanese reconnaissance plane flying near Midway made a weather report referring to AF, leading him to realize the atoll was the target. But this was not concrete enough for his superiors, who still believed the Japanese would bypass the islands and invade Hawaii. Some of them even believed their target was actually the US West Coast, potentially in revenge for Doolittle's raid. He therefore came up with a cunning plan, which he hoped would prove he was correct. He sent instructions to a US submarine to pass a message to the radio operators on Midway, instructing them to transmit a message that indicated that the salt water evaporators on the island had broken down. Around 2 days later, Rochefort was informed that his team had intercepted a coded Japanese message, which said that AF was low on fresh water. There was no doubt anymore. The Japanese were going to attack Midway in force with the intention of capturing it. Rather than go through the regular channels, Rochefort took the rather brazen action of contacting an old friend, Lieutenant Commander Edwin Layton, who was now serving as an intelligence officer to Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, the commander-in-chief of the US Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor. It may have cost him friends above him in the chain of command, but Rochefort's decision to bypass his senior officers certainly paid off, as even Nimitz was now convinced. Over the coming weeks, as Nimitz reorganized his fleet to respond, more information was intercepted, including the Japanese battle plan and even the date at which it was due to take place. Instead of Yamamoto springing a trap for the American carriers, he was now sailing into Midway, blissfully unaware that Nimitz was himself setting a trap for the Japanese carriers. On May 5th, 1942, Japan's Imperial General Headquarters issued Yamamoto Navy Order No. 18, authorizing his Midway campaign. Yamamoto's strategy for the Midway offensive was both ambitious and complex, involving five separate phases, each with their own goal. The combined naval force committed to the operation included 11 battleships, one of which was the super battleship Yamato, which would serve as Yamamoto's flagship, and four large fleet carriers, all of which had participated in the Pearl Harbor surprise attack. Supporting them were a force of 23 cruisers, 67 destroyers, and 22 submarines, as well as three smaller light carriers, although these wouldn't be present at Midway. However, the first phase of the overall plan would actually take place some 1,668 miles to the north, in the Alaskan Aleutian Islands, and was scheduled for June 3rd. The Aleutian invasion force was intended to help anchor the Japanese advance eastward towards North America, preventing the US from using the islands to attack Japanese targets in the northern Pacific or launch a counterattack against Japan's fleet from behind. For Yamamoto, the Aleutian campaign also served as a distraction for the attack on Midway, which would take place the next day on June 4th, delaying American response and allowing his invasion force more time to capture and secure Sand Island and Eastern Island, setting the bait for the American carriers. Prior to Vice Admiral Nagumo's force of fleet carriers, known as the Mobile Force Striking Midway, a three-tiered submarine cordon was to be established between the atoll and Hawaii. These would monitor the approach of the American fleet, allowing Yamamoto to fine-tune his trap for the American carriers. Approaching from the northwest of the atoll on the morning of June 4th, the powerful air wing of the mobile force would attack Midway, bombing the airfield and shooting up the U.S. Marines' defensive positions, softening them for the two invasion forces, one for each island, to attack, while Nagumo relocated his fleet to ambush the Americans once they arrived. Overall responsibility for planning the invasion fell to one Commander Toyama. However, he found he had to do so only with a scant picture of what the Japanese ground troops could expect. Intelligence regarding the US forces at Midway was poor, and Toyama even lacked any recent maps of the two islands. Reconnaissance efforts had proved fruitless due to a large number of US Marine Corps fighters based on the island, preventing any of Japan's long-range flying boats from scouting ahead. So much of what they had planned for was based on speculation, guesswork, or at best, out-of-date information. In fact, both the Japanese Army and the Navy disagreed significantly on the numbers of American service personnel they were expecting to find, the Navy assuming it would be little more than the pre-war number of around 750, while the Army reasoned it would be closer to 2,000, given the atoll's importance to the US war effort. In fact, the number was close to double the Japanese Army's estimation, thanks to reinforcements from the US Army Air Force being rushed to the islands. Assigned the task of invading Sand Island was Captain Ota's 2nd Combined Special Naval Landing Force, numbering about 1,500 Japanese Marines, while invading Eastern Island would fall to the Imperial Japanese Army's Ichiki Detachment, numbering 2,000 men, commanded by Colonel Ichiki. Both were considered some of Japan's elite assault troops, and during the invasion, they could call upon significant air and naval gunfire support to suppress American resistance. While he may have had the troops for the job, Toyama soon discovered that the Navy lacked the flat-bottomed boats needed to get said troops to the island from their troop ships, forcing him to ask to borrow some from the Army, a difficult task for a proud Japanese sailor. Then, finally, on June 6th or thereabouts, the American fleet would arrive, at which time Yamamoto could close the trap on them. For the commander of the mobile force, Vice Admiral Nagumo, destroying the American carriers and effectively defeating the US Pacific Fleet would also allow him to silence much of the criticism he had been receiving regarding his handling of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Specifically concerning his cancelling of a follow-up attack, believing that with the Americans now on alert, it would be a waste of pilots and aircraft to attack again, especially since the carriers were not there. Yamamoto supported Nagumo's decision, but it left the Vice Admiral the subject of criticisms and accusations from his rivals. On paper, the Japanese plan was logical based on the intelligence they had, but of course in reality, Lieutenant Commander Rochefort had now completely torpedoed it before it even began. Thanks to the efforts of his team and other Allied codebreakers, Nimitz knew almost as much about the plan as the Japanese leaders. Furthermore, with so many factors at play, it would take a great effort on the part of Yamamoto's staff to coordinate it all, but in order to maintain secrecy, much of it would be done in total radio silence, forcing all concerned to stick to a precise timetable. This meant that the plan was both inflexible and had little consideration given to any unexpected developments. Its first failure was the submarine cordon. Aware of the Japanese submarine force's goal, Nimitz moved his three carriers, the Enterprise, Hornet, and Yorktown, to a position north of the islands before the subs could get into position, meaning they were waiting to spot a fleet that had already passed them. Now it was the Japanese intelligence team's brief time to shine. Having detected a dramatic increase in radio traffic around Pearl Harbor, they correctly reasoned that American carriers were setting sail, yet this information didn't make it to Yamamoto's fleet due to the standing order for total radio silence. However, despite their advance notice of the Japanese fleet's plan, the odds were still rather firmly stacked against the US Navy. Along with the three carriers, Nimitz could only muster 8 cruisers, 14 destroyers, and 19 submarines to take on the Japanese fleet. This was, effectively, what was left of the US Pacific Fleet after Pearl Harbor, and the string of engagements that took place afterwards. There was even some concern that Yorktown wouldn't be able to make it, the carrier having to undergo repairs from the Battle of the Coral Sea, but while arriving later than planned, it was able to reach Midway before the Japanese arrived. If this were not enough, combat losses, particularly amongst air crews, meant that a large number of the men manning these ships and aircraft were rather green and would be facing a numerically superior Japanese force who had a wealth of combat experience under their belts. There was some solace to be found in that Midway itself effectively added a fourth air wing into the mix to balance it out, including a flight of the US Army Air Force Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress Heavy Bombers, and even six of the then brand new Grumman TBF torpedo planes, originally destined for the Hornet, but the bulk of the fighters were throwaways from the US Navy, their performance falling far below what was required to fight the lethal Japanese Zeros. In order to ambush the Japanese carriers, the three American carriers were arranged into two task forces. Task Force 16 was commanded by Rear Admiral Raymond Spruance and was comprised of the Enterprise and the Hornet, along with support from six cruisers and nine destroyers. Commanding Task Force 17 was Rear Admiral Frank J. Fletcher, who had overall command of the two carrier groups from his flagship, the Yorktown. Supporting Yorktown in Task Force 17 were two cruisers and five destroyers. By June 2nd, both task forces were on station approximately 200 miles north from Midway, lying in wait. Shortly before 300 hours, on the morning of June 3rd, 1943, two Japanese light carriers, the Ryujo and the Junyo, sailing near the tip of the Aleutian Islands, under the command of Admiral Kakuta, began launching aircraft to initiate the Aleutian campaign. The single-engined carrier bombers arrived over Dutch harbour on Amaknak Island just over an hour later, as dawn began, and bombed oil storage tanks, the island's radio station, and the US Army barracks at Fort Mears. Meanwhile, further south, Vice Admiral Nagumo was about to realize that unlike Pearl Harbour, the Midway campaign would not enjoy the same level of surprise. Initially, as his fleet got within 1,000 miles of Midway, he had encountered thick fog, which pleased him, as it would help conceal their final approach. But at the same time, it had prevented him from sending out his own reconnaissance aircraft to scout for enemy aircraft and vessels. Meanwhile, further west and behind the mobile force, Admiral Yamamoto aboard the mighty battleship Yamato was also growing concerned about the increase of radio traffic coming from Midway, although he was confident Nagumo had not yet been detected. All that changed at approximately 900 hours, when a US Navy consolidated PBY Catalina flying boat from the Patrol Squadron 44, piloted by Ensign Jack Reed, spotted the Japanese transports carrying the Imperial Japanese Army and Marines for the invasion. Located some 600 miles from Midway, the only aircraft the Americans had to reach them at that distance were a flight of US Army Air Force Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses. Nine B-17s took off from Midway at approximately 1,230 hours and headed for the last reported position of the Japanese ships. Much was expected of the fortress bombers, their cumulative firepower being deemed sufficient for them to fight their way through any Zeros patrolling around the fleet, while their altitude capabilities would leave them out of range of much of the Japanese. If these planes could blast cities into dust, surely ships didn't stand a chance. Unfortunately for the Americans, these hopes proved unfounded, as even with their famed Norden bomb sights, as they made their attack at 1530 hours, it was found to be all but impossible to strike the ships below, as they engaged in anti-aircraft maneuvers. The B-17s failed to hit any of their targets, the bombs instead exploding in the water, sending impressive-looking streams of water skyward. However, it was not all for nothing, as some of the B-17 crews took to photographing the Japanese fleet while they flew over, helping intelligence analysts back on Midway determine the exact size and disposition of the enemy they would be facing. The Midway flyers were not done yet, though, and as the late evening fast approached, four US Navy Catalinas were armed with torpedoes and sent out on a night torpedo attack. During the attack, one Catalina scored a hit on a Japanese oil tanker, although this failed to sink the vessel. While Nagumo may have lost the element of surprise, he still had significantly greater strength than what he was expecting to encounter coming from Midway, and so during the night, he ordered his men to begin their final preparations for the attack the next day. Unknown to him, Admiral Fletcher, aboard the Yorktown, was doing the same. Beginning at 430 hours, the Japanese force began launching scout aircraft, not from the carriers, but from the battleships and cruisers. These seaplanes were catapulted off the warships and would then land in the water behind the ship and be hoisted back on board. One such scout plane-carrying ship was the Tone Heavy Cruiser, which launched two E-13A seaplanes to scout ahead for any American ships or aircraft. Meanwhile, Nagumo's strike force began getting underway, amidst a break in the thick fog the fleet had been experiencing. The Akagi and Kaga deployed a force of 36 D-3A dive bombers, while a similar number of Nakajima B-5N bombers launched from the Hiryu and Soryu. Each of the four carriers also carried 9 A-6M-0 fighters for escort and strafing ground targets. Almost 1 hour later, a Catalina, this time flown by Lieutenant Howard P. Addy, spotted one of the Japanese carriers and alerted Midway, which began scrambling into action. He then took cover in clouds before venturing back out and spotting a second carrier and a large fleet of warships. A short while later, another Catalina to the south of his position spotted a large formation of Japanese aircraft heading for Midway, and pilot Lieutenant Junior Grade William A. Chase sent the now famous message. Many planes heading Midway, bearing 320 degrees, distance 150. Shortly before 600 hours, radar operators on Midway began detecting the Japanese planes, allowing them to begin vectoring in the island's fighters. Stationed on Midway were an assortment of 28 fighters, the majority of them being Brewster F-2A-3s, an aircraft that had been proven hopelessly outclassed in combat with the Zero. Operated by U.S. Marine Corps Squadron VMF-221 and led by Major Floyd B. Parks, only 24 aircraft were operational, and all took off to meet the 116 incoming Japanese planes. The last fighter had barely gotten airborne when the first of Midway's offensive aircraft began lifting off immediately after them. Unfortunately, the torpedo and bombing aircraft were an eclectic mix of Navy, Marine, and Army Air Force types, which made coordinating the attack difficult. As well as the B-17s, the Army Air Force had deployed four twin-engined B-26 Marauders to Midway, these having been hastily adapted in Hawaii to carry air-launched torpedoes, something the Army pilots had never trained to use. First to get airborne, however, were a flight of six Navy Grumman TBF torpedo bombers, these having only just entered service, and which would be better remembered later as the Avenger. The TBFs headed out in formation westwards towards their targets, passing near the incoming Japanese force en route, the Japanese pilots only paying a token interest in them, knowing that Nagumo had left sufficient numbers of Zeros back on the carriers for defense. Pressing on towards Midway, the Japanese soon met Major Park's men, who had split into two formations to prevent any of the attackers from slipping by unchallenged. The resulting air combat was savage in the extreme. Parks was hit early in the fight and managed to bail out, but to the horror of his men, a Japanese pilot shot him as he hung helplessly in his parachute. 15 other Marine fighters would be shot down in the engagement, with only two pilots surviving the melee. The remainder all limped back to Midway with heavy damage, and only two of them were ever in a condition to fly again. The US air opposition having been neutralized, the Japanese bombers went in, encountering intense anti-aircraft fire from the US Marine ground gunners. The bombers made a powerful attack on the air base, bombing aircraft and hangars while trying to avoid the runway, the hope being that it could be used for Japanese aircraft once the islands had been captured. They also struck the power station on Eastern Island, damaging fuel pumps, meaning aircraft had to be refueled from drums manually, and blowing up oil storage tanks, sending a menacing black cloud into the sky that could be seen for miles as it burned. By 715 hours, the attack was over and the all-clear was sounded, allowing the American defenders to assess the damage and tend to their wounded. Despite the carnage, Nagumo was now left with a problem, as the raid's leader broke radio silence and informed the Vice Admiral that a follow-up raid was going to be needed to complete the mission. However, this was contrary to Yamamoto's orders, which required him to keep his aircraft ready to do battle with the US fleet when it arrived. Perhaps still smarting from the criticism over his handling of the Pearl Harbor attack, he decided that this time he would send out another wave, and he ordered that the planes he kept in reserve be made ready for attack. Almost at that same time, the American offensive aircraft began to reach the Japanese fleet. The TBFs broke into two sections and made their attack, opening their torpedo bay doors well in advance of reaching their targets so they could still drop their weapons if their hydraulic systems were hit by Japanese fire. Making their attack runs, the TBFs were set upon by the Zeros and massacred. Only one of the six would survive, albeit with a dead tail gunner and seriously wounded pilot and radio operator, and none would score a hit on the Japanese fleet. Following closely behind the TBFs were the B-26s, which then began their own attack run, aiming for the four carriers at the center of the Japanese fleet, which had begun to break up in taking offensive maneuvers. The B-26s, led by Army Captain James Collins, soon came under attack by Zeros. But Collins and another B-26 flown by First Lieutenant Jim Murray pressed on and aimed their torpedoes for the Akagi, on board of which was Nagumo. Despite taking a huge amount of punishment, the rugged B-26s survived hundreds of bullet hits, only for the pilots to miss their target as the ship swung around hard to evade their weapons. That didn't stop Murray's crew putting a few dozen machine gun rounds onto the ship's deck, however, before the wounded planes made good their escape back to Midway. Another B-26 was mortally hit, however, and its crew appeared to attempt to ram the bridge of the Akagi, but lost control at the last second and crashed into the sea. Had they succeeded, they might very well have killed Nagumo. Less than half an hour later, the third American attack wave arrived in the guise of 16 Douglas Dauntless SBD-2 dive bombers of the U.S. Marines Scout Bombing Squadron 241. Operating in three sections, the dive bombers flew in at 8,000 feet before making their attack, releasing their bombs and then attempting to hide in the clouds as they made their escape. Once again, the Japanese defenses fell on them, and only half would make it to their targets, although none would score a hit on the carriers, and two more were brought down trying to escape. Next, it was again the turn of the B-17s. 15 B-17s had originally been tasked to make a second attempt on the troop ships, but were then ordered to switch to the Japanese carriers. Attacking at 815 hours, they found the Japanese fleet had lost its cohesion, and was largely scattered as a result of the hard maneuvering it had undertaken in the face of the previous attacks. Flying at 20,000 feet, they were immune to the fleet's guns as they attacked, but while they did manage to drop bombs so close to the Hiryu and Soryu that the seawater sprayed the decks, they failed to hit their targets. All 15 aircraft returned to base safely, the Japanese Zeros deciding it wasn't worth the risk of losing aircraft to the powerful defensive guns of the Flying Fortresses if their enemy's accuracy was so poor. The last attack from Midway came at 820 hours in the shape of 11 obsolete, lumbering Vindicator torpedo bombers, which made an attack on the Japanese battleship Haruna. Again, no hits were scored, but eight of the aircraft managed to return to base, although they were so badly damaged they never flew again. The air crews of Midway Island had thrown everything they had at Nagumo's fleet and appeared to have nothing to show for it. However, in actuality, the attacks had broken up the Japanese fleet's tight formation, creating gaps in their defensive screens. This was only exacerbated by the appearance of the American submarine, USS Nautilus, under the command of Lieutenant Commander William H. Brockman, which made three determined but unsuccessful attacks on the Japanese fleet. This, in turn, forcing the Japanese to undertake anti-submarine sweeps. Also, having had to commit his reserve fighters to defend the fleet, many Zeros were now having to land back on the carriers to rearm and refuel. Nagumo couldn't have known it at the time, but he was now more vulnerable than he had ever been, and Admiral Fletcher aboard the Yorktown was just about ready to step into the ring. It was in the middle of the Midway aircraft's attack that one of the E-13A scouts flying from the heavy cruiser Tone made a surprising discovery. Flying 240 miles to the north of the atoll, the crew of the scout spotted 10 American warships, which they identified as being equal numbers of destroyers and cruisers, no threat to the Japanese carriers and battleships. Yet, this was not what Nagumo was expecting to have to contend with on the first day of the battle, and so, anticipating a surface engagement with the US Navy, he ordered that any B-5N torpedo bombers, not already bombed up to participate in a second attack on Midway, be fitted with torpedoes instead. It was at 820 hours, shortly after the B-17s made their run, that the Tone's scout plane reported back more serious news. The message read, "Enemy force accompanied by what appears to be aircraft carrier bringing up the rear." This alarmed Nagumo, and he immediately ordered his bombers that were set to attack Midway to rearm again, this time with torpedoes and armor-piercing bombs. Striking the American carrier quickly was of paramount importance. However, given how scattered the Japanese fleet was after the successive attacks, he had launched all his remaining fighters on a large patrol around them to protect from further American raids while the fleet formed up, meaning he had none to spare to escort the torpedo bombers. Many of those directly under him pushed Nagumo to order an attack, whether they had fighter escort or not, as they didn't want to waste this opportunity to sink an American carrier. However, Nagumo had seen firsthand how ineffective the American torpedo planes had been against his own fighters without an escort, and so he decided to wait until his carriers had recovered and refueled enough fighters to adequately cover them. While this was being done, at 920 hours, the first American carrier-launched strike began with 15 Douglas TBD Devastators arriving from the USS Hornet. Again unescorted, the lumbering torpedo bombers were cut apart by Nagumo's fighter patrols, not one surviving the battle. Another 14 Devastators made an attack shortly afterwards, aiming for the Kaga, but despite having a flight of Grumman F-4F Wildcats nearby, a breakdown in communications meant that they too went in without fighter escort. 10 were shot down, while 4 managed to get off their torpedoes, only for them all to miss the Japanese carrier. Now it was the turn of the Yorktown's air group. 12 Devastators, escorted by 6 Wildcats, made their attack at 1010 hours and were quickly pounced upon by Zeros. The fight was so intense that the Wildcats could barely protect themselves, let alone the torpedo bombers, who nonetheless pressed home their attack, losing 10 of their number, and again, without scoring a single torpedo hit on the Japanese carriers. By now, the decks of the 4 Japanese carriers were a hive of activity, as mechanics and armorers raced to get aircraft airborne and into the fight. Bombs, fuel, and ammunition were everywhere, and it was only the almost drone-like discipline of the Japanese crews that was preventing this deadly cocktail turning into a disaster. They also had a remarkably quick turnaround for their aircraft, nearly half of what the Americans were achieving, a testament to their skill and dedication. It was as this activity was taking place that fate showed its hand in Nagumo's fortunes. Flying from the Enterprise, 31 dauntless dive bombers, led by Lieutenant Commander C. Wade McCluskey, had been searching for the Japanese carriers for 2 hours without luck. Instead, he spotted the lowly Japanese destroyer Arashi steaming at full speed and suspected it was trying to rejoin the carriers. In fact, it had been pursuing the Nautilus, which had taken it away from the fleet and into the sights of McCluskey. Tailing it, his hunch was rewarded by the sight of the Akagi and the Kaga in close formation amidst their escort fleet, with the Soryu off to the east and the Hiryu just beneath the horizon. McCluskey selected the 2 closest carriers for his attack and broke his formation up into 2, one for the Akagi and one for the Kaga. Making their approach, they observed the massacring of the Devastators below them and realized that the Japanese were so focused on bringing them down, they were approaching almost totally undetected and would be so until they began their dives. Dropping bombs and incendiaries, the Americans finally managed to put bombs onto the 2 Japanese carriers, these punching through the wooden decks into the hangars below, the fuel and ammunition stored there only multiplying their effectiveness as they detonated. Both carriers soon erupted in flames that engulfed their aircraft and began to consume the ships, and with his flagship, the Akagi, now a burning mess, Nagumo transferred his flag to the cruiser Nagara. Both ships were now firmly out of the fight. Then, just minutes later, another flight of SBDs, this time from the Yorktown, appeared on the scene. At 1028 hours, Lieutenant Commander Maxwell F. Leslie led 17 dive bombers against the Soryu, achieving an equal level of devastation. It wouldn't be appreciated until much later, but in the course of just 5 minutes, the Enterprise and Yorktown's dive bombers had not only completely reversed the fortunes of the Americans at Midway, but of the whole Pacific theater. In just 5 minutes, they had won the war in the Pacific. commanding the only remaining Japanese carrier, the Hiryu, was Rear Admiral Tamon Yamaguchi. Yamaguchi was a tough and daring commander who earlier that day pressed Nagumo to launch an attack on the first American carrier that had been detected without even a fighter escort. Now he was steaming toward the American fleet's position, his pilots bent on avenging their comrades, but what Yamaguchi didn't know was the exact strength he would be facing as he sailed into a trap of three American carriers, albeit ones with their strength depleted from their own attacks on the Japanese ships. At 10:54 hours, six Zeros took off from the Hiryu's deck to escort a force of 18 D-3A dive bombers heading for the American ships. Led by the experienced Lieutenant Kobayashi, the attack force came across the Yorktown just before noon and observed the American carrier launching another wave of dauntless dive bombers. Wildcat fighters on patrol above Yorktown were vectored in to engage the Japanese, and 10 of the D-3As fell to their guns, while two more were brought down by anti-aircraft fire during the attack. Unfortunately, it was not enough, as three Japanese bombs struck the Yorktown, disabling it and leaving it effectively dead in the water. The surviving Japanese aircraft returned to the Hiryu and made a startling report to Yamaguchi of the exact strength of the fleet he was facing. Knowing that Yorktown was badly damaged, he ordered a follow-up attack using his ship's B-5N torpedo bombers to target the Enterprise and Hornet, with the attack reaching the American fleet at 1,432 hours. However, by that time, a frantic damage control effort meant that Yorktown was now back under its own power, and consequently, the commander of the B-5Ns mistook it for one of the unscathed carriers. Attacking in two groups from opposite sides of the Yorktown in order to split up American defensive fire, the B-5Ns pressed home their attack with great skill, and while the Yorktown managed to evade two torpedoes, it was struck at 1,442 hours, hauling the mighty ship, causing seawater to flood in, resulting in the ship starting to list on its side. Fearing the carrier would capsize, Captain Elliot Buckmaster ordered his crew to abandon ship. However, this success had cost Yamaguchi dearly. Taking stock of the Hiryu's remaining air wing, he found that he was left with a fraction of what he had started the day with. Just six Zero fighters, five D-3A dive bombers, and five B-5Ns. This was all the air power the Japanese now possessed in the battle, save for the float planes aboard some of the larger cruisers and battleships. Yet he was undeterred, and planned a third strike at dusk with his remaining aircraft, hoping to use the low light to conceal the small force. That attack would never take place. At 705 hours, lookouts from the Japanese fleet spotted a formation of 40 dauntless dive bombers launched from the Enterprise and the Hornet. 13 of them made an all-or-nothing attack on the Hiryu, while the remainder began targeting the carrier's escort ships. Four bombs struck the carrier, causing massive damage as armed and fueled planes exploded, their own weapons helping to turn the Hiryu into a charred and broken mess. The resulting fires burned wildly out of control, the damage control teams unable to stem them as they battled tirelessly into the night. Having lost the fight to save them, Kaga and Soryu were abandoned in the late afternoon before slowly sinking. Nagumo's former flagship, the Akagi, remained afloat until just before dawn on June 5th, when it too succumbed to its damage and sank. Hiryu remained afloat into the early hours of June 5th, despite an effort to scuttle it using torpedoes fired from Japanese destroyers after the crew had abandoned ship, save for Yamaguchi and the ship's captain, who decided to die with their ship. In the rear guard aboard his flagship, the Amato, Admiral Yamamoto was horrified of the news that all four carriers had been lost. In a last-ditch effort to salvage some sort of victory from the growing disaster, he ordered his battleships and cruisers to engage the American fleet in night combat, knowing they would have a distinct advantage in firepower, and the fact that darkness would limit American air power, hoping to destroy the Enterprise and Hornet before retreating. However, Admiral Spruance, commanding the carriers in Task Force 16, had anticipated this and withdrew eastward before returning in the morning, by which time Yamamoto had realized all was lost and had called off the Midway operation. Before receiving this word, however, two cruisers, the Mogami and the Mikuma, approached Midway and began shelling shore-based installations. They were unsuccessfully attacked by an American submarine, but as they undertook evasive action, they collided with one another, causing extensive damage. Yamamoto left two destroyers to act as escort for the damaged cruisers, which couldn't keep up with the main fleet as it retreated. Sensing blood, American aircraft attacked them relentlessly, Mikuma being reduced to nothing more than charred and twisted metal, but the Mogami miraculously survived and returned to Japanese waters despite immense damage. As for the Yorktown, efforts were made to tow it back to Pearl Harbor yet again to repair its ship with power. Then, on the afternoon of June 6th, the Japanese submarine I-168 spotted the carrier and launched an attack with torpedoes, which hit both the carrier and its surrogate destroyer. Yorktown capsized and remained afloat until 458 hours on the morning of June 7th, when it finally slipped beneath the waves. The Battle of Midway was over. Against the odds, the United States had inflicted an unprecedented victory over the Japanese fleet. Four fleet carriers, the right hook of the Imperial Japanese Navy, were gone. It was a loss they would never recover from. Japan would scramble to get new carriers into service to replace them, mainly by converting other ships, including the 3rd Yamato-class battleship, which became the Shinano, the largest carrier ever built at the time, but it was to no avail. As for the Japanese who landed in the Aleutians, they captured the islands of Attu and Kiska before hunkering down to a bitterly cold winter. Then, in the following summer, a combined US and Canadian force landed and destroyed them, completely recovering the islands by August 15, 1943. The American industrial complex was now in full swing and was far outpacing Japan's war production. Hundreds of ships, including aircraft carriers, were being churned out by American shipyards, compared to just a handful by Japan in the same period. Yet Tokyo stubbornly refused to surrender, and it would take 3 years of bloody and brutal warfare to force them to finally submit. And it was all thanks to the victory at Midway.